actions, I'm going to now call the second case of today's calendar, 99-3266 CR, State v. Joseph Rizzo. Arguing for the state is Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle. Mr. Castle.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. The primary issue in this case is whether defendant Joseph Rizzo is entitled to a new trial because the trial court denied his request that the teenage victim of his repeated sexual assaults be required to submit to a psychological examination by a defense expert. The Court of Appeals held that because of a single answer given by a prosecution witness in the course of a five-day trial, the defendant was entitled under State v. Mayday to have his expert examine the victim. Because the defendant was denied that opportunity, the Court of Appeals concluded, he was entitled to a new trial. In Mayday, the Court of Appeals held that when the state retained a psychological expert to examine a sexual assault complainant for the purpose of giving an opinion under State v. Jensen, the defendant may be entitled to have the court order that the complainant submit to an examination by a defense expert. The Court of Appeals held in this case the testimony of Dr. Linda Pusey, who was the victim's treating therapist, about the reasons why victims of sexual assault may not immediately report the crime. That testimony was tantamount to Jensen evidence. The Court of Appeals also held that the fact that Dr. Pusey was the victim's treating therapist rather than an expert engaged by the state was not relevant to the question of whether the defendant was entitled to have his expert examine the victim. The state believes that the Court of Appeals was wrong on both counts. Dr. Pusey's testimony was not Jensen evidence, and more generally, it was not the type of testimony that would require a personal examination of the victim by a defense expert to rebut.
Counsel, just so I noticed you sat here prior case, we had some discussion on what and what is not Jensen evidence. And it was read right here from the bench. What exactly, in your opinion, is Jensen evidence? What
I will admit to the court that I shared the somewhat broader view that counsel for the state in the prior argument had, that Jensen evidence applies whenever an expert gives testimony about the common behaviors exhibited by sexual assault victims, whether that is reactive, that is the acting out behaviors, or the delayed reporting behaviors, and then offers the opinion that the behaviors of the victim in this case are consistent with those commonly observed characteristics.
So that's not what was at issue in the case, that the defendant
did
not challenge the admissibility of the testimony about reporting behaviors.
Yes, clearly in Jensen, the behavior and the testimony at issue dealt with reactive behaviors, the acting out, precocious sexual behavior, or other kinds of behaviors that are more directly probative of whether the victim or the complainant is truly a victim of a sexual assault, as opposed to the delay in reporting type behaviors, which merely serve to explain to a jury why delayed reporting does not necessarily mean that the victim is not telling the truth.
What does Jensen then trigger? What does this Jensen evidence, once everybody agrees that it's a testimony about common behavior of a victim, what rights does that trigger vis-a-vis the defendant?
I guess I would say it's more than testimony about common behaviors of victims. It is the testimony not only of common characteristics of victims, but an opinion offered by an expert that the behavior of the complainant in this particular case is consistent with those commonly
That's part of Jensen evidence.
That's,
then what does that trigger? What rights does that trigger in the defendant? for the defendant?
It depends on the basis, the expert's basis for that opinion. The Court of Appeals concluded in State v. Mayday, and the state has not taken issue with that framework, that when the state hires an expert, that is, goes out and tries to generate evidence not otherwise available by getting an expert, having the victim cooperate with that expert, submit to an examination by that expert, then the expert comes into court and says, here are the common characteristics of a victim of sexual assault, and here is my opinion that those, that the victim, that the complainant in this case, is consistent with those. When the state has offered that kind of testimony, we would agree with the Court of Appeals in Mayday that fundamental fairness would require that the defense have the same opportunity.
What same opportunity?
To have the victim examined by a defense expert for the purposes of developing testimony.
I don't know that you ever finished your answer to my question about, or I didn't hear an answer to my question, a complete one anyway, about why it is you think Jensen evidence includes evidence about reporting behaviors when that was not at issue in the case.
Strictly speaking, Jensen does not. But I think conceptually it's similar, that there is evidence about common characteristics of sexual assault victims, and then the opinion about why this victim's...
Is there any case, reported case, that construes evidence about reporting behaviors as Jensen evidence?
I can't think of one. I think that...
So everybody in the entire state may be operating under
that is,
conception of what Jensen evidence is. Either that or I'm the only one in the state who interprets it this way.
That may be. I look back, prompted by your question during the previous argument, I look back at the Mayday case to see what the nature of the so-called Jensen evidence there was, and Mayday itself, in the opinion, doesn't say whether it was reactive behaviors, reporting behaviors, or both. I checked with my colleague who argued the case to see what was involved, and I can tell you if you wish to know, but the decision itself doesn't make that clear. I think it's clear the Court of Appeals in this case was assuming that reporting type behavior comes under the rubric of Jensen. Now, I think the Court of Appeals, even if that assumption is correct, and the assumption that I've been working on, that reporting behaviors can fall under the rubric of Jensen, I think the Court of Appeals was incorrect in characterizing this as Jensen evidence for a separate reason. And that is, as I said, I think the essence of what Jensen was all about is that comparison. The expert offers the opinion not just that these are the common characteristics, but the opinion that the victim in this case exhibits similar characteristics. And I think if you look at Dr. Pusey's testimony, there is no opinion offered to that extent.
If Jensen means what you and many people seem to think it means, that testimony about reporting behaviors of sexual assault victims is Jensen evidence, then don't we have Jensen evidence in almost every single sexual assault case that's ever tried?
Not if there is not that opinion, that ultimate opinion, making the comparison. So I don't think we have that necessarily in every case. We certainly do commonly have exactly the kind of testimony that we saw here.
Well, isn't it true that in most sexual assault cases, there are witnesses called to testify about the circumstances under which the victim reported and how the victim reported, and then they are asked often follow-up questions after cross-examination about the consistency of reporting delays, complete reporting and so forth with the reporting behaviors of sexual assault victims in general, whether that comes from the person at the Sexual Assault Treatment Center or the person from the Sensitive Crimes Unit of the Police Department or from an outside expert, as in this case.
That's right.
That's very common sexual assault cases.
And the Court of Appeals in Mayday, and in this case, I think, linked the defendant's right to whether that opinion was offered by someone who had conducted a psychological examination of the complainant in that particular case. And in fact, often there is no need for Jensen evidence to be put in by someone who has any particular knowledge of this victim. That is based on any personal interview.
There was an exchange between the state and the defense about the state's intention to put in Jensen evidence.
That's correct.
And then there was a motion for a psychological examination, and the state pulled back. What was the evidence that they intended to introduce that they ultimately didn't introduce?
I think it's not absolutely clear from the record, but I think it is that ultimate Jensen question. Is the complainant's testimony consistent with these generally observed characteristics? This court had already established...
When you see the way the question was posed by the prosecutor and then the answer, why doesn't that go to the heart of what you're saying?
Because I think if you look... Well, there are two reasons. One is specific to the answer that Dr. Pusey gave. She framed her answer in the most general characteristics about common reasons. She talks about people are reluctant to report this kind of thing. Often people are embarrassed. They may be afraid. Sometimes they have positive feelings. Those tend to be the most common reasons. I think that is not Jensen evidence. Putting aside the issue of whether Jensen is limited to reactive or reporting behavior, if you look at a case decided before Jensen, State v. Robinson, the court had already said that it is proper for an expert to testify about the most or about common post-assault behaviors. Now, again, I understand in Robinson that also involved reactive behaviors. But the whole issue in Jensen was not the evidence of common characteristics. That had already been decided by the court prior to Jensen. In Jensen, the defendant was saying, that's as far as the state can go. It can put on the common characteristics, but it is improper to give the opinion that the victim, in this case, is consistent with those because that's tantamount to testimony that the victim was assaulted by this defendant, and the court said no, that is proper expert testimony. So the prosecutor in this case did what was already permitted by pre-Jensen law and not the expansion that Jensen gave, that is, just offering the common characteristics.
And I think, let me ask this. When that question was asked, and exception was taken to the question, your position then is that the court ruled correctly?
Yes, that it was proper for the court to allow that question because it was not seeking Jensen evidence. The prosecutor had said, prior to trial, I will not seek Jensen evidence. Now, perhaps the prosecutor was right for another reason, because this had nothing to do with reactive behaviors. It was reporting behaviors. And,
isn't a reporting behavior a reactive behavior?
Well, conceptually, there is a difference. Both deal with the responses of the victim to sexual assault. But one, the reactive behaviors are, I think, more directly probative that something has happened to this complainant. The reporting behaviors is more a way of rebutting an inference that just because the complainant didn't report for a month or a year.
So which one's less damaging or more damaging to the defendant?
It may be apples and oranges. I think they're offered for different purposes. I guess I can't answer in any general sense. They're both damaging to the defense and they're both probative.
Well, it goes back to the point that you just made, that one is rehabilitative and the other is corroborative. One is offered affirmatively to corroborate the victim's story. The other is offered to rehabilitate or respond to a line of argument and questioning by the defense that seeks to undermine.
Correct. And I think...
Mr. Castle, let me, if I might interrupt for a minute. Let's assume for a minute that this was Jansen type of testimony. One of the things that concerned me, if I remember the Court of Appeals opinion correctly, was that the Mayday case involves a number of factors that are to be applied. Did the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, ever apply those factors or discuss those factors?
Not at all. And I think that's one of the problems with the Court of Appeals opinion. The Court of Appeals opinion says, send it back for a new trial. And I think under Mayday, the fact that the state is going to elicit Jensen testimony is just the trigger. It's the threshold for the request. And then the defendant has to make the showing. Now here...
Well, should the Court of Appeals have examined the record then in regard to Mayday, or is that something that should be asked to do on remand?
Well, I think I've asked this court to conclude, and I think the Court of Appeals could have concluded, that the defendant had not made a sufficient showing that as a matter of law, ordinarily it certainly would be a discretionary determination by the trial court, but I think we don't have here anything from the defendant to explain why there was a compelling need to submit the victim to the intrusion that this examination would entail. And I think looking at this in the post-trial setting, we look at the opinion that Dr. Pusey gave. Victims are afraid, sometimes they've been threatened, sometimes they're embarrassed. Well, why is it that the defense needs to have an expert examine the victim in this case to respond to that? That was testimony about common characteristics. Neither the Court of Appeals and nor do I believe the defendant has ever explained what it is that a defense expert's examination of the victim in this case would do to respond to that opinion about the common characteristics.
What was the purpose of Dr. Pusey's testimony?
Well, Dr. Pusey provided a factual background about how this came to be reported, provided some prior consistent statements, and I will note there were never any objections by the defense in general to Dr. Pusey providing this.
I haven't read all of Dr. Pusey's testimony, just excerpts of it. But as I recall the facts, the state brought Dr. Pusey from Tennessee a couple of times to testify. Now, can you glean from the I would hope you can glean from the testimony in total what the purpose is. Otherwise, it's a waste of money and time to bring a witness if you can't see what the purpose is. What was the purpose of Dr. Pusey's testimony?
I think, well, in hindsight, if you read the trial transcript, I think Dr. Pusey turned out to be perhaps unnecessary in the sense that the victim here provided such strong and compelling testimony.
Let me ask in a different way. Does the record reflect a primary purpose of Dr. Pucci's testimony other than to testify regarding behavior and consistency of behavior?
Yes, that was, well, that question was a single question asked of Dr. Pucci in a long examination. The purpose, the state went into great detail without any objection by the defense about how Dr. Pucci first encountered the complainant, the initial course of treatment, what the presenting problems were, how those were handled, how the complainant in the first round of treatment made a veiled reference to some guy messing with her, and how the treatment stopped, how it resumed afterwards, and at which point the victim, having had revealed finally to the authorities, also then made it a subject of the treatment. Because there is another issue, I don't want to lose track of it. I think it's the secondary issue, but the Court of Appeals, in a footnote, also addressed the issue of the access to the treatment records here. And I want to, before my time expires, make sure I get into that. In a footnote of its opinion, the Court of Appeals held that the trial court erred when it denied the defendant's request for the victim's psychological treatment records. That was Dr. Pucci's file of the sessions that the complainant had with Dr. Pucci. That issue first arose in the pretrial context when the defendant made a request under Shifra for those records. The state acknowledged that there had been a sufficient preliminary showing made to warrant an in-camera examination. And after reviewing the records in camera, the trial court found that there was not even a remote possibility that there was anything exculpatory in the file, and also said that it had compared that file line by line with a summary report that Dr. Pucci had prepared, and found that there was nothing in the treatment records relevant to this case that had not already been disclosed to the defense in that summary report. The issue of access to the treatment records arose again at trial during the state's direct examination of Dr. Pucci. Defense counsel said, now we're in trial, I'm entitled to see those treatment records, and he asserted two grounds for that access. The first, without specifically citing the statute, was an apparent reference to Section 906.12, in which defense counsel said he assumed that Dr. Pucci had reviewed the file before testifying, and that the defense was therefore entitled to review the documents for purposes of cross-examination. Second, defense counsel argued that he was entitled under Section 907.05 to have Dr. Pucci disclosed the facts and data underlying her opinion. If I understand the defendant's brief correctly, he is not basing his claim on appeal on the denial of the pretrial disclosure of the victim's record. And I think my reply brief focused too much on the pretrial disclosure, not appreciating what I think was the focus of the defendant's brief in this court, which is suggesting that he, as a result of Dr. Pucci's testimony, he became entitled to access to the victim's treatment records. As I've noted, at trial, the asserted basis was both 906.12 and 907.05, but in both the Court of Appeals brief of the defendant as well as his brief in this court, there's no reliance on 906.12, and I think that's for a very good reason. Section 906.12 requires, as a predicate for requiring production of a document, a showing that the witness used that document to refresh the witness's memory for purpose of testifying. There is nothing in the record, however, to indicate that Dr. Pusey reviewed the treatment file to refresh her memory for purposes of testifying at trial. The defendant does rely on Section 90705 in his brief, but that reliance is misplaced. Section 907.05 provides that the expert may be required on cross-examination to disclose the facts or data underlying her opinion. In this case, however, Dr. Pusey's opinion was not based on the complainant's treatment records. She offered an opinion about the common reasons why sexual assault victims are reluctant to report the crime. The facts or data underlying that opinion are not to be found in the files of this victim or in any other individual treatment files. If they were, then Dr. Pusey would be required to produce all of her files in which she treated sexual assault victims. Rather, that type of opinion is based on her training, her professional experience, her review of the literature, and so on. The defendant's counsel was free to inquire into the data underlying Dr. Pusey's opinion on cross-examination, but that did not require disclosure of the victim's file. I want to point out something that I noted in preparation for our argument that I also did not note while working on my reply brief. The defendant's brief ends with the last paragraph of his argument on the records ends with a discussion of a couple of cases of this court, Vinicky, the Midland Mutual being one of them, purportedly for the right of access to materials relied on by an opposing expert. But the defendant's brief substantially misquotes this court's opinion in that case. The quoted phrase in the brief about access simply does not exist in this court's opinion. Moreover, the issue in Vinicky, as well as in Carl's, the other case cited by the defendant, had nothing to do with access. Both cases involved admissibility of evidence rather than access to information by opposing counsel. And I see my red light is on.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Castle. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Franklin Gimbel, representing the defendant, Joseph Rizzo. Mr. Gimbel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court and the courts of appeals throughout the state of Wisconsin have said on frequent occasions, and I am an ardent supporter of the notion that the trial of criminal cases are not sporting events. They are rather an attempt to avoid trial by ambush, and there should be a sharing of information between the parties. This is a unique case in that I was the trial lawyer in Kenosha, the appellate court lawyer in Waukesha, and the advocate before this honorable court. Without hoping to sound immodest, I think I did everything right in this case in front of Judge Fisher with respect to the Madej issues, the Shifra issues, and the Jensen issues. That is that I think that in advance of the court starting this trial, those areas of concern were raised to the court very elaborately in oral argument, in the presentation of evidence, and the presentation of legal authorities. The outgrowth of that was that a dialogue occurred in connection with the February 4th pretrial motion hearing, and I think this in a significant way responds to Justice Prosser's first questions of Mr. Castle. And that dialogue involved the district attorney in this case, in my view, essentially conceding that there was Jensen-type material that would flow from the interaction between psychologist Dr. Pucci and the victim, Danielle Falvo, and that she was going to assure the court, and did, in no uncertain terms. And her statements are part of the record of both in the transcript of that proceeding on February 4th And for easier access for this court, if you look to the petition for review that was filed by Mr. Castle before this court, he attaches to his petition for review the dialogue between the court, Ms. Rush, and myself on the issue of how Dr. Pucci was going to be used. And this spills over, I suggest, to some of the questions of Justice Walsh Bradley, because I agree with at least the implication of Justice Walsh Bradley's question that the only reason that the state called this psychologist was to set the table to prepare for the defenses in this case. And the defenses in this case were not mysterious. The defenses in this case were that this young lady was a lying, manipulative, troubled young person who was referred to a psychologist by patients with those labels, not labels that I, the defense lawyer in this case, created, but labels created by her parents to the psychologist. And the psychologist did her summary report in advance of the court ruling on whether or not I should have access to the psychologist's files, put in quotation marks that description of this young lady. And in her testimony, when I questioned her, she said that that was not a quote, that that was paraphrasing some comments that she got from some source. She didn't know what the source was. And I thought that was telling for me as an advocate for Mr. Rizzo in the trial court to open the door to my looking at that file. Because if this was, in fact, a characterization of behavior that existed for this young lady prior to the time she went to the police and reported this conduct, then I think that goes to her believability and presents an argument for the jury. But back to my first point. The district attorney in this case on February 4th said to the court, I am not going to use Dr. Pucci as an expert in the sense of offering Jensen testimony. And more specifically, she said, and I'm quoting now, if I do think it's necessary to elicit some Jensen testimony, I will call another expert and certainly put the court and defense on notice with the curriculum vitae attached. Thereafter, when I responded to that, because she did say in her comments that if the defense opens the door to my getting into Jensen-type evidence through Dr. Pucci, I reserve the right to ask the expert questions. I said to the court, I don't know if I'd just been handed a hand grenade with a pin out, and I don't know whether I should throw it away or hold it and explode myself. And what I had in mind was, and how the court responded to me was, that really the district attorney is setting me up or setting up the case for the prosecution to essentially attempt to get in Jensen-type evidence without the predicate right of the accused in this case to enlist his own expert to examine this person and thereafter then be available upon a proper showing of the bidet factors, which Justice Crooks called to the attention of all of us here in this courtroom, must be demonstrated by a defendant as a predicate to getting that expert on the witness stand. But we were cut off at the pass on February 4th in this case by the judge who said, on the basis of this, on the representations made by the state, that they weren't going to use Dr. Pucci for Jensen-type evidence, and that they were going to get Jensen-type evidence, they would identify that up front, let the court know, let the defense know, and then we can reconsider whether or not there should be an examination of this young lady. The court agrees that you are not entitled to any independent psychological examination. From my point of view, as the advocate for Mr. Rizzo on that day and thereafter throughout the trial, I never was in a position to find a relevant place to talk about the Madej six or seven factors, because I was told, hey, it's not an issue in this case. Go home and figure something else out.
Mr. Gimbel, do you think the Court of Appeals, in its examination of this case, should have looked at those factors, however, and discussed those factors?
No. There was nothing to look at, Justice. There was nothing to look at because we were cut off at the pass. There's not going to be any kind of psychological examination of this complaining witness because the state isn't going to venture into the territory of Jensen. And if they don't venture into the territory of Jensen, all the factors become irrelevant.
Now, your position is they did venture into Jensen. Is that your position?
They absolutely ventured into Jensen, yes, without a question.
In what way?
In the way that if you look at the actual testimony of the doctor, come back quickly. If you look at the actual testimony, what you have when Dr. Pucci was examined as a witness is you have a travelogue-like scenario, the essence of which was, now, as Mr. Castle indicated, tell us about when you met this young lady, what were the circumstances of that meeting, and then in this first relatively brief encounter that you had with her for a couple of months, what did she tell you, and what did you tell her, and how did you deal with her psychological issues? And then some year later, when she had gone to the police and had gone to the district attorney's office and had reported what became the case against Mr. Rizzo, at that time, she again got into the mix and very interestingly got into the mix in association with the victim witness protective employee of the district attorney's office with whom this particular psychologist had written books, had put on seminars, and the same person that this psychologist invited into sessions with the complaining witness. So, to the argument that the state makes that this psychologist was not hired as an expert, I retort, they did better than that. They really got the benefit of a superb bargain. They picked up a treating psychologist who they were able to use as a Jensen-type expert with a lot more persuasiveness, I suggest, than they would have gotten had they gone to the Yellow Pages, found somebody, and said, in advance of trial, go talk to this young lady because we're going to call you as an expert and find out why she didn't report this for a year or some other aspect of her behavior that was consistent with other sex abuse
victims. Dr. Pucci ever say, here's what the victim did. Here's what the common characteristics are of a sex assault victim. They are consistent. She didn't testify that way.
Not those terms, but what she did say, and it's not a big, long answer, she said that people, and I suggest to you that this woman is a marvelous tool for prosecutors in sex assault cases because she knows all the right answers, what words to use and what words not to use. And after all, why shouldn't she know that when she was and advertised herself to be a person who was an expert on child abuse cases and worked in concert with the victim witness coordinator for the district attorney's office and the police department? So the answer to your question, Chief, is that what she did is first she walked through, here are all the things that Rizzo did to her that intimidated her, frightened her, said he was with the mafia, said he'd killed her family, was a neighbor, was a dear friend. The testimony in the trial up to that point also discloses that according to the mother of the victim, he had made some inappropriate sexual advances to her in advance of her turning her daughter over to this man and having her daughter in a room next door to where she and her husband were sitting without asking what's going on there for a period of months. And she was offended by the fact that he had made some allegedly inappropriate sexual advances towards her, the mother. So I suggest to you that if you put in the framework of the testimony of Dr. Pucci, what the prosecutor elicited from her and then look at the answer to her question, which invites an answer to a question that says, how does her not reporting this compare with this case, essentially? She says, well, people don't often report because of these reasons, all of which she had already identified as circumstances of the relationship between the alleged assailant and the complainant.
So Mr.
she set the table for this. Yes, Justice.
You don't seem to be at any loss of words, and yet when that question was asked, your response was, objection, Your Honor. And there weren't many words there.
Correct.
What was going on?
Well, what was going on was I was putting an umlau in the record because I had been slapped down on the issue of, A, getting my own psychiatrist or psychologist to investigate or to meet with this young lady in advance of trial. The judge made it very clear to me that you're not going there. I had been slapped down with respect to getting at the records of the psychologist in this case. The judge made it very clear to me, you're not getting the records. Now, if I were going to replay that again, and the same question was asked by the Court of Appeal to me in our oral argument, why didn't you leap up and say, hey, let's go back to what the district attorney said on February 4th, when she is a predicate to your denying the defendant an opportunity to have an independent psychological, said, I'm not going to call an expert, and if I do, I'll give you notice up front. I wish I would have said that.
Well, you never would have said that in front of the jury, though, right?
I would not have said it in front of the jury, of course not. No. But I might have said, put time out, give me a sidebar, give me another hearing.
Let me ask this. Suppose we pose the question to these high school students. Why might a sexual assault victim delay reporting the assault to the police? Don't you think that they would be able to come up with basically the same answers that Dr. Pucci did?
I mean, maybe yes. But the point is that if they did, I don't know what a great impression they'd make on the jury. And that's no disrespect to these students. But here comes the district attorney of the state of Wisconsin and brings a lady in from Tennessee three times. If you look in the record, Ms. Rush makes a very particular point to say, we have paid for this woman to come here three times. We paid her airplane tickets, we paid her meals, we paid her hotel bills. Now, the state in their brief said that wasn't a hired expert of theirs, it was my person somehow. I don't know how. I didn't subpoena her, I didn't attempt to bring her there. She didn't help my case in any way. But in any event, the point of the matter is that when you have somebody who's got this curriculum vitae, which means resume, and that person gets up there and speaks very eloquently and speaks with the authority of having dealt with a victim, supposed victim, over a period of many, many months, and says, here's the reason why you, defense lawyer, are full of baloney when you're going to argue to the jury that this never happened, that this young lady made it up, because if it had happened, she'd have been distressed while it was happening. She would have cried out to her parents, hey, I'm being assaulted. That didn't happen. She would have said, and her parents would have said, this is an outrage. Let's go to the police. Let's go to the district attorney. That didn't happen. None of those things that we traditionally think of as being indications of someone being in the true victim's position happened here. And so I suggest that I was in a position as the advocate for Mr. Rizzo and at the trial level to argue to the jury, this young lady is not believable for the following reasons. And a spear was put in my heart.
Is it your position that she was just lying about 5-6 months of sexual assault?
Yes, I think she was exaggerating and lying. I really do believe that. But
hey, did she have any record of false accusations?
She did, on the basis of the intake notes of the psychiatrist. The psychologist put down that her parents brought her there because she was lying, manipulative, and...
What about this letter from the attorney in Kenosha with all these incidents? Why didn't you introduce evidence of that?
I'm sorry, I'm missing the point. What letter is that?
Wasn't there another attorney, not you, but another attorney who had a list of 6, 7, 8 incidents? Why didn't you...
Oh, yeah, well, there was an attorney that was of counsel to me in the case, Mr. Severs, and what we were attempting to do is we were attempting to find an opportunity to present evidence of other untruthful allegations of sexual misbehavior. We were cut off at the pass on that, but I didn't take that issue.
You could have introduced that.
I didn't take that issue up.
But that had been introduced under the rape shield law?
It was blocked by the rape shield law. And I accepted that decision of the court, didn't take it up on the Court of Appeals as one of what I thought to be a significant issue. But it was a pretrial issue. There were allegations made, and we called a police officer in the case, that a Kenosha police captain's son had sexually assaulted this young lady, that another person had sexually assaulted this young lady. And we were working to get that into the mix for the jury. We were cut off by the judge on the rape shield law, and I didn't take that issue of that ruling up.
What if instead of the victim's treating psychologist being the one who offered this testimony, it was instead a detective from the Sensitive Crimes Unit or a nurse from the Sexual Assault Treatment Center who had been asked about common reporting behaviors of sexual assault victims and whether the victim's behavior in reporting or not reporting was consistent with that.
You're asking me if my opinion that opens up the Jensen?
Right. Is that Jensen evidence that opens up the door to a Mayday?
The answer is yes and no. If in fact that person, regardless of his or her occupational label, had been developed as having a certain amount of expertise with respect to common characteristics of sexual victims, and then on the basis of that special expertise, a question had been asked, I believe that would open the door to the same kind of decision that the Court of Appeals made here, that in combining Jensen. Come in with expert credentials to contradict that, if in fact that person would contradict it on the basis of his or her examination of the victim.
Well, now that's the kicker.
Well, and I think that doesn't that turn into, as a follow-up to your answer, doesn't that turn almost every sexual assault trial into a potential Mayday private defense examination of the victim? Because in almost every sexual assault trial, the detective who takes the victim's statement is asked questions like that, and the nurse at the sexual assault treatment center who examines the victim is asked questions like that by the prosecution, either on direct or on redirect.
In recent years, I haven't tried a lot of sexual assault cases, but I have over 40 years tried many of them. I have found that pre-Jensen, pre-Mayday, it was not unusual for me to encounter as a lawyer prosecutors using police officers, for example, or witness protection people as experts, and it was kind of so be it. But I think subsequent to Jensen and Mayday, which are cases of the 90s, I certainly would feel as an advocate at the trial court level that if a prosecutor tried to frame the qualifications of a police officer, a social worker, or someone in the system as an expert, I think that does open up the same kind of opportunity for rebuttal that Mayday and Jensen read together provide.
Well, but counsel, seems to me that what you have in this case is somebody who has had prolonged relationship with the victim. I'm talking about the doctor.
Yes.
And has treated this person. And now comes up and testifies. And if your position is then, look, you got somebody who treated her and has a psychological profile on her, then you ought to be able to do the same thing. I mean, I think that's what I hear you say. But as presented by Justice Sykes, and in the Jensen case, you had, I don't remember if he was a teacher, but he was in the school system,
and he reports on what he has observed of the victim. I think that it's, I find it hard to believe that that if you have a detective that describes what ordinarily victims do and is asked the question, now in this case, this victim did such and such, and are they consistent? I find that hard to understand why you ought to have a psychological examination of her by your expert, and then you put that on. I mean, we're way beyond. I mean, it looks like collateral, as we used to say. Maybe we still say that. So that's what I think is the key difference in the question posed by Justice Sykes and the example in this case, and that's why some of us keep coming back to what exactly is her testimony. Is it on the basis of her examination of this person, or is it on the basis of just common knowledge, all of which is damaging to your case? I agree.
Her testimony was framed by the prosecutor as a question predicated on her common knowledge as an expert dealing in the area of sexual assault cases.
That's
not a question.
Okay.
I mean, I don't suggest that it's other than that. However, you know, I go back to the fact that the prosecutor set the table for her to have a different kind of an appearance and a different level of acceptability for the jury.
Suppose they hadn't set the table. Suppose they had done what Justice Sykes suggests, or what I suggest. They just ask her, the basis of your expertise in this field, what are the reactions of a victim? And then we're going to tell you what her reactions are, and are they consistent? Mm-hmm. Would you demand a psychologist expert?
I would always demand a
psychologist. I understand that, but we're not going to turn you down. Are you going to be up here and winning?
Would I persuade the trial judge to accede to my demand? Only if I could walk him or her through the seven steps of Medea. If I couldn't do that, I lose, and rightfully so.
And so you think Medea just applies anytime you've got somebody bringing in testimony about the common reactions of...
I do believe that to be true. And I think what is really interesting, and while I don't know that it has...
Let me just finish. Medea had a state bringing in psychological examination by the state's experts. So that's why I read Medea to only cover that situation, not cover the situation as presented by Justice Sykes or myself.
And my dialogue with Justice Sykes, understand, Chief, is hypothetical. And she asked me what I think. And that's what I think. And I'm going to be honest about it. Do I think it has... Her question has great application to how you resolve this case? No. I think you should resolve the case before you here on these facts. And these facts are very uniquely aimed at what I consider to be the marriage of Medea and Jensen to provide an appropriate threshold for Mr. Rizzo to have had an opportunity to have this young lady examined by somebody in the context of and the anticipation of what this testimony was going to be, and that there was going to be a torpedo that hits our submarine, you know, in that sense.
But the threshold here was, you're saying, was set up by the prosecutor because they told you they were going to do A and they did B. And
they told the court that. And I was a witness to it, yes, and a victim of it.
Right.
True.
Which is not always in every case.
It surely is not. No. I think the Court of Appeals made that a point. I think the Court of Appeals was ready to turn the prosecutor into then Vapper, now Oler, but that's beside the point. I mean, clearly that was a linchpin, in my view, was a linchpin blockade to my getting into the Medea factors, because the judge said, look, the prosecutor's told us she's not going to call an expert and offer Jensen testimony. That issue's closed. Get on to something else.
Counsel, you speak of this marriage between Jensen and Medea. As I understand the state's position, even if Dr. Pucci's testimony is Jensen testimony, that rather than the remedy
of the Court of Appeals, that is, you get a new trial. They advance that you have to go back for a hearing and that you have to clear three hurdles. You have to show that you have a compelling need, you have to run through the seven steps of Madej, and then do a harmless error sort of approach. And if you lose, you don't get a new trial. Can you respond to the remedy advanced by the state?
Well absolutely, because then the prosecutor wins, because she's got her conviction based on lying to the court, lying to the defense, and then she can go back on the remand if it's not for a new trial and say, I changed my mind. If there were a retrial, I'm not going to call an expert witness. So now, Mr. Gimbel, you go ahead and now convince the court why it would have made a difference. Now, where do I go? Am I going to get an expert to go and see this young lady so that I can fashion a response to the seven factors of Madej? I don't think so. I mean, I could fashion it myself here without an expert. But, I mean, legitimately, can I do it? No. What we need to do is we need to go back to square one. This conviction was tainted by the unfair play of the prosecution in this court and by the impatience of the trial judge. And I say that lovingly. I mean, Judge Fisher's a boyhood friend of mine. But he didn't have a lot of patience for me because I warned him in the pretrial proceedings to get to these two areas. And I didn't get there. And in the middle of the trial, when I made my objection, albeit perhaps not articulated to the extent that I maybe should have on a sidebar basis or away from the jury. But the point of the matter is that the only remedy that works to ensure fairness for Joe Rizzo and all other defendants similarly situated is for this court to say, you play these games at the peril of losing your conviction and starting over again. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals was saying. And I don't think that's inappropriate. I don't think there's an alternative remedy. The remedy is a new trial, start from scratch, because the harm has been done here to Mr. Rizzo and his relationship with that jury. And so I don't know how you can go back as a convicted person and then say to the defense counsel, you try to change the facts here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Gimbel. Mr. Castle.
I want to start with a few words in defense of the prosecutor, because there's been some harsh language used by Mr. Gimbel and, frankly, in the Court of Appeals opinion, suggesting that the prosecutor reneged on her assurance not to use Jensen evidence. And I do this not only to defend the prosecutor's good name, but because Mr. Gimbel has tried to tie that into the remedy should he prevail in this court. My position is the prosecutor did not renege. She did not present Jensen evidence. But her representation to the court was that she would not present Jensen evidence, and we've just spent 55 minutes discussing whether or not it was Jensen evidence. But I think even if this court were to conclude that it were, the proper way to look at this is, what difference did it make? We are post-trial. This was, even if the court decides that this was Jensen evidence and the prosecutor was wrong to have introduced this, this is not the kind of structural error or fundamental unfairness that would require a new trial, irregardless of whether it made a difference. And so I come back to
finish your sentence.
I come back to the question: what would a defense examination of the complainant have yielded? What kind of opinion would that have yielded, and how could it possibly have made a difference? Now, I'm not suggesting at this point in the proceeding we can say there is no possible opinion that a defense expert might have come up with that would have made a difference. I think it's pretty unlikely, but in fairness to the defense, I don't think we can conduct that harmless error type analysis quite yet. But I think if the court were to conclude that the trial court improperly denied the examination, the remedy is not automatically a new trial, that there has to be an examination of what difference did it make, and that starts with an examination by the trial court of the Mayday factors to determine whether the defendant has made a sufficient showing. Only if the trial court concludes that there should have been an examination under the discretionary application of Mayday does it matter. If I'm perhaps not giving you a chance to answer your question, so I'll stop there.
Okay. This is the trouble that I have with your position that this is not a Jensen case. You state in your brief on page 22 that the defining characteristic of Jensen evidence is that it's opinion testimony by the state's expert that the complainant's behavior is consistent with the behavior of victims of the same type of crime. I think I tend to agree with that statement. But you seem to be making a very fine distinction between the question that is asked and the response that is given. Because as I read the question that was asked by the prosecutor, she was very clearly asking for a Jensen response. She used words like, under these circumstances, and in this position, and in a crime like this. So even though the expert did not respond in kind, in other words, she gave a much more general response, nevertheless, the question was designed to elicit a Jensen response, and it seems to me that a jury looking at this as a whole would say, well, that's what she meant. This is the question that was asked, and so therefore she was doing this. So your brief never mentions that, and so you seem to be taking the position that a Jensen question does not at all trigger Jensen evidence unless the expert opinion echoes the question.
Well, I think that the prosecutor's question was ambiguous in the sense that it was not clear from the prosecutor's question whether she was saying, you know, in a person like this or someone like this.
Why someone would not report a crime like this under these circumstances? You say that's ambiguous.
It could be a referred to, yes. And I think the best evidence of that is look how Dr. Pusey responded to it. She did not. She responded to it as though it were a general question. So I think in the context, I mean, I guess I have no better evidence of why I think that the question could be interpreted that way. It was that that's how the witness interpreted it.
Well, in a prior statement on 21 to the top of 22, it seemed to indicate two things. One, whether she made the comparison with the victim. And two, whether she did it on the basis of her personal experience with the victim. So, what is your position if you don't have a psychologist who has examined the victim, but you have somebody who is knowledgeable about sexual assault victims generally? Take the police detective that Justice Sykes posed. Or take the school teacher in Jensen. And they do know the victim. And they do make the comparison, a full comparison, about reporting, for example. Is it your position that the Day case applies?
No, it would be our position that it doesn't. In fact, the Court of Appeals dealt with that, I think Schaller was the case where it was very similar, where there were witnesses who had interactions with the victim but had not conducted any psychological examinations.
Now, in your first part of the brief, you indicate that the Madej case has been relegated to its facts, which is an expert examining. A state expert examining the victim. And is that the state's position? Does the state want Madej overruled?
No, the state is quite content with Madej, although you can't tell it from the Madej opinion. There was a supplemental brief filed by the state in Madej that essentially advocates the procedures and standards that the Madej court adopted. I think the state would, as the Court of Appeals did in other opinions, limit it to the situation as in Madej, where the state goes out and hires an expert and the victim consents to be examined by those experts.
Thank you, Mr. Kessel. Thank you, Mr. Gimbel. That ends our hearing on 99-3266 CR.